Fear of criticism. The majority of people permit relatives, friends, and the public at large to influence them so that they cannot live their own lives because they fear criticism. Many people make mistakes in marriage but stay married because they fear criticism. Millions of people neglect to go back and get an education after having left school because they fear criticism. Countless numbers of men and women permit relatives to wreck their lives in the name of family duty because they fear criticism. People refuse to take chances in business because they fear the criticism that may follow if they fail. The fear of criticism in such cases is stronger than the desire for success. Too many people refuse to set high goals for themselves because they fear the criticism of relatives and friends who may say, "Don't aim so high. People will think you are crazy." When Andrew Carnegie suggested that I devote 20 years to the organization of a philosophy of individual achievement, my first impulse was fear of what people might say. His suggestion was far greater than anything I had ever conceived for myself. My first instinct was to create excuses, all of them traceable to the fear of criticism. Something inside of me said, "You can't do it. The job is too big and it requires too much time. What will your relatives think of you? How will you earn a living? No one has ever organized a philosophy of success. What right have you to believe you can do it? Who are you anyway to aim so high? Remember your humble birth. What do you know about philosophy? People will think you are crazy." And they did. Why hasn't some other person done this before now? Later in life, after having analyzed thousands of people, I discovered that most ideas are stillborn. To grow, ideas need the breath of life injected into them through definite plans of immediate action. The time to nurse an idea is at the time of its birth. Every minute it lives gives it a better chance of surviving. The fear of criticism is what kills most ideas that never reach the planning and action stage. The habit of doing more than paid for. A few years ago, I was invited to deliver the graduation address before the students of a college. During my address, I dwelt at length and with all the emphasis at my command on the importance of rendering more service and better service than that for which one is paid. After the address was delivered, the president and the secretary of the college invited me to join them for lunch. While we were eating, the secretary turned to the president and said, "I have just found out what this man is doing. He is putting himself ahead in the world by first helping others to get ahead." In that brief statement, he had epitomized one of the most important parts of my philosophy on the subject of success. It is literally true that you can succeed best and quickest by helping others to succeed. Some years ago, when I was in the advertising business, I built my entire clientele by applying the fundamentals upon which this lesson is founded. By having my name placed on the lists of various mail order houses, I received their sales literature. When I received a sales letter or a booklet or a folder that I believed I could improve, I went right to work and made the improvements, then sent it back to the firm that had sent it to me with a letter stating that this was but a trifling sample of what I could do, that there were plenty of good ideas where that one came from, and that I would be glad to render regular service for a monthly fee. Invariably, this brought an order for my services. Even on the one occasion when a firm was dishonest enough to appropriate my idea and use it without paying me for it, it still turned out to be an advantage to me. A member of the firm who was familiar with the situation started another business, and as a result of the work I had done for his former associates, for which I was not paid, he hired me at more than double the amount I would have realized from his original firm. When Charles M. Schwab first came to Andrew Carnegie's attention, Schwab was working as a day laborer in one of Carnegie's steel plants. Mr. Carnegie observed that Mr. Schwab always performed more and better service than that for which he was paid. Moreover, he performed it with a pleasing attitude which made him popular among his fellow workers. Mr. Schwab was promoted from one job to another until he was finally made president of the Great United States Steel Corporation at a salary of $75,000 a year. What's more, on some occasions, Mr. Carnegie not only paid Mr. Schwab's salary, but he also gave him a bonus of as much as $1 million. Think of it. Charles M. Schwab, the day laborer, could never have earned that much in his entire lifetime. A salary of $75,000 a year paid to a man who started as a day laborer, plus a bonus of more than 10 times that amount. Why do you suppose Mr. Carnegie paid him that much? When asked, Mr. Carnegie said, "I gave him his salary for the work he actually performed, and the bonus for his willingness to go the extra mile, thus setting a fine example for his fellow workers." The habit of giving more service and better service than you are paid to render is absolutely essential to the marketing of yourself and your personal services. Among the many sound reasons for rendering more service and better service than expected are the following. 1. This habit turns the spotlight of favorable attention upon those who develop it. 2. This habit enables you to profit by the law of contrast, since the majority of people have formed the habit of offering as little service as they can get away with. 3. This habit gives you the benefit of the law of increasing returns and insures against the disadvantages of the law of decreasing returns, eventually enabling you to receive more pay than you would receive without this habit. 4. This habit ensures you preferred employment at preferred wages. The person who practices this habit is the last to be removed from the payroll when business is poor and the first to be taken back after a layoff. 5. This habit develops greater skill, efficiency, and also greater earning ability, and it tends to give you preference over others. 6. This habit makes you practically indispensable and will prompt your employer to delegate greater responsibilities to you. The capacity to assume responsibility is the quality that brings the highest monetary returns. 7. This habit leads to promotion because it indicates that those who practice it have ability for supervision and leadership not found in those who follow the opposite habit. 8. This habit enables you to set your own salary. If you can't get as much as you deserve from one employer, it may be obtained from the competitors. Every business has either a potential or a real asset known as goodwill. It is an asset without which no business can grow. An individual who renders more service and better service than paid for may also be said to have this goodwill asset. It is generally known as your reputation for efficiency. It is an asset without which you cannot market your personal services to best advantage. The strongest and most attractive selling feature any individual has is the habit of rendering service that is greater in quantity and superior in quality. The habit of rendering more service and better service works in behalf of an employer, just as it does in behalf of an employee. Every individual who works for a salary naturally wants more money and a better position. Not every such individual, however, understands that better positions and greater pay come as the result of motive, and that the greatest of all motives with which these desirable benefits may be attracted is that of rendering more service and better service than one is paid to render. You are a merchant, and your ability is the product you sell. Use the same principles of sound judgment in marketing yourself that a successful merchant uses in marketing products. You know, of course, what happens if you are a merchant who shortchanges the customers. You lose their business. On the other hand, you also know what happens to the merchant who builds confidence by rendering service and delivering merchandise that meets the customer's expectations. Most people can cheat others occasionally without detection, but you can't cheat others without observation by your own conscience. Your conscience is the official recorder of your acts and thoughts, and it writes the record of every thought and deed into the fabric of your character. A clear conscience is an asset comparable to no other, especially when you are selling yourself. Master salesmanship, regardless of the wares you may be selling, is based upon absolute faith in the thing you are offering for sale. How can you believe in yourself if you know that you have cheated? Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote in his essay, Compensation, "The law of nature is, do the thing, and you shall have the power. But they who do not the thing have not the power. Men suffer all their life long under the foolish superstition that they can be cheated. But it is as impossible for a man to be cheated by anyone but himself as for a thing to be and not to be at the same time." We go through two important periods in life. One is that period during which we are gathering, classifying, and organizing knowledge, and the other is that period during which we are struggling for recognition. One of the most important reasons why we should always be not only ready, but also willing to render service, is that every time we do so, we gain an opportunity to prove to someone that we have ability. We go just one more step toward gaining the necessary recognition that we must all have. Instead of saying to the world, "Show me the color of your money, and I will show you what I can do," reverse it and say, "Let me show you the color of my service, so that I may take a look at the color of your money if you like my service." Here is a perfect example that involves a woman who was working as a stenographer at $15 a week. Judging by the salary, she must have been none too competent in that work. About 10 years later, this same woman was clearing a little over $100,000 on the lecture circuit. What bridged that mighty chasm between these two earning capacities? The habit of doing more than is paid for. This woman became well known throughout the country as a prominent lecturer on the subject of applied psychology. Let me show you how she harnessed the law of increasing returns. First, she went into a city and delivered a series of 15 free lectures. Anyone could attend at no charge. As she was delivering these lectures, she had the opportunity of selling herself to her audience, and at the end of the series, she announced the formation of a class for which she charged $25 per student. That's all there was to her plan. While she was commanding a small fortune for a year's work, there were scores of much more proficient lecturers who were barely getting enough from their work to pay their expenses, simply because they had not yet familiarized themselves, as she had, with the fundamentals upon which this lesson is based. If this woman lecturer, who had no extraordinary qualifications, could harness the law of increasing returns and make it raise her from the position of stenographer at $15 a week to that of lecturer at over $100,000 a year, why can you not apply this same law so that it will give you advantages you do not have now? Several years ago, I was invited to deliver a lecture before the students of the Palmer School in Davenport, Iowa. My manager completed arrangements for me to accept the invitation under the regular terms in effect at that time, which were $100 for the lecture plus my travel expenses. When I arrived in Davenport, I found a reception committee awaiting me at the depot, and that evening, I was given one of the warmest welcomes I had ever received during my public career up to that time. I met many delightful people from whom I gathered many valuable facts that were of benefit to me. Therefore, when I was asked to make out my expense account so the school could give me a check, I told them that I had received my pay many times over by what I had learned while I was there. I refused my fee and returned to my office in Chicago, feeling well repaid for the trip. The following morning, Dr. Palmer went before the 2,000 students of his school and announced what I had said about feeling repaid, and he added, "In the 20 years that I have been conducting this school, I have had scores of speakers address the student body. But this is the first time I ever knew a man to refuse his fee because he felt he had been repaid for his services in other ways. This man is the editor of a national magazine, and I advise every one of you to subscribe to that magazine, because such a man as this must have much that each of you will need when you go into the field and offer your services." By the middle of that week, I had received more than $6,000 for subscriptions. During the following 2 years, these same 2,000 students and their friends sent in more than $50,000 for subscriptions. Tell me how or where I could have invested $100 as profitably as this. One rainy afternoon, an elderly lady walked into a Pittsburgh department store and wandered around in an aimless sort of way, very much in the manner that people who have no intention of buying often do. Most of the salespeople gave her the once-over and busied themselves by straightening the stock on their shelves so as to avoid being troubled by her. One of the young men saw her and made it his business to inquire politely if he might serve her. She informed him that she was only waiting for it to stop raining, that she did not wish to make any purchases. The young man assured her that she was welcome and, by engaging her in conversation, made her feel that he had meant what he said. When she was ready to go, he accompanied her to the street and raised her umbrella for her. She asked for his card and went on her way. The incident had been forgotten by the young man when one day he was called into the office by the head of the firm and shown a letter from a lady who wanted a salesman to go to Scotland and take an order for the furnishings for a mansion. That lady was Andrew Carnegie's mother. She was also the same woman whom the young man had so courteously escorted to the street many months previously. In the letter, Mrs. Carnegie specified that this young man was the one whom she desired to be sent to take her order. The order amounted to an enormous sum, and this incident brought the young man an opportunity for advancement that he might never have had except for his courtesy to an elderly lady who did not look like a ready sale. Just as the great fundamental laws of life are wrapped up in the commonest sort of everyday experiences that most of us never notice, so are the real opportunities often hidden in the seemingly unimportant transactions of life.